The Rosicrucian movement is a mystical fraternity, which by necessity operated in secret for much of its existence. It claims that its roots originated in ancient Egypt, from the time of Pharaoh Thutmose III, who organized the first esoteric school of initiates, founded upon principles similar to those perpetuated today. Some modern researchers, however, assume that the Rosicrucian movement originated with a group of German Protestants between 1607 and 1616, when three anonymous documents were published in Europe. They were called Fama Fraternitatis Rosacrucis, Confessio Fraternitatis, and the Chimical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz Anno 1459. The Rosicrucians believe that it is not only possible, but essential to personally know through direct experience the source of all being, that is God. Vegetarianism is considered a very important part of the evolution of the individual, and is justified on scientific, occult, and ethical terms. Rosicrucians are seen as sharing ancient knowledge with the purpose of manifesting an awakening from the intellect to a mystical consciousness or enlightenment. We invite you today to hear the sage teachings from The Secret Doctrine of the Rosicrucians.
The Secret Doctrine of the Rosicrucians, Part 8, The Three Higher Planes of Consciousness. We have now reached that stage of our presentation of the subject of the secret doctrine of the Rosicrucians, and particularly of that phase known as the seven planes of consciousness. Accordingly, our present consideration is with those three great planes of consciousness which begin with the plane of human consciousness and include the planes of the consciousness of the demigods, and which find their highest manifestation on the plane of the consciousness of the gods.
While these three higher planes of consciousness are included in the Rosicrucian symbol of the seven planes of consciousness, i.e. the seven linked circles, the Rosicrucians have also a special symbol by which they seek to indicate these three wonderful higher planes of consciousness, viz. The symbol of the three linked circles. It will be noticed here also that each of the circles are linked with the two on either side of it, the circumference of each circle extending over that of the two others on either side of it. This indicates that each plane of consciousness is blended with the others, a truth which will be made more apparent as we progress with our commentary on the teaching in this chapter.
5. The plane of human consciousness. The plane of human consciousness, as its name indicates, is that plane of conscious activity which is manifested by human beings, high and low, in varying degrees. This plane of consciousness, like all the others of the seven planes of consciousness, is divided into seven sub-planes, and each of these into seven, and so on. Moreover, at one pole, this plane is linked with and blends into the highest sub-planes of the plane of animal consciousness, while at its other pole it blends into the lower sub-planes of the next highest plane, i.e., the plane of the consciousness of the demigods.
Again, following the symbol of the three linked circles, the same individual who manifests on the plane of human consciousness is, in a measure, in touch with the two higher planes, known respectively as the plane of the consciousness of the demigods and the plane of consciousness of the gods. The reason that the Rosicrucians place these three higher planes of consciousness in a trinity of circles, apparently apart from the lower four planes, is that on these three higher planes of consciousness, the individual soul manifests self-consciousness, or the consciousness of I am, in at least a certain degree, while on the lower four planes this consciousness of I is entirely absent, and the mental activity is more or less automatic and instinctive. This distinction will be brought out as we proceed.
On the very lowest forms of human consciousness there appears at least a faint glimmering of self-consciousness, or the conviction that I am I, that form of consciousness by means of which the human individual becomes aware of himself as an individual entity. This, rather than the degree of intellectual development, is the characteristic distinguishing mark of the human being.
But we must not fall into the error of supposing that the primitive man, or even the less developed individuals of modern civilization, possess this faculty of self-consciousness to a high degree. On the contrary, with both of these types, this form of consciousness may be said to exist merely in a dawn state, and yet the dawn is a distinct advance upon the darkness of the mental night. A modern psychologist says of the comparatively higher forms of self-consciousness, "Many persons never have more than a misty idea of such a mental attitude. They always take themselves for granted and never turn the gaze inward."
The development of the higher forms of self-consciousness may be noted in the gradual unfoldment of the mind of the young child, for on the mental as well as on the physical plane, the young of the human being rapidly passes through and reproduces the stages of the evolution of its ancestral forms.
At a certain stage of the mental evolution or development of the young child, there comes a particular period at which the child seems to awaken to a dawning realization that it is an individual, instead of being merely a bunch of feelings and desires. Up to a certain point, the young child speaks of itself in the third person, i.e. as John, Mary, etc. Then all of a sudden it begins to employ the terms I or me in speaking of itself. Though it may make grammatical errors in using these pronouns, nevertheless, there is never any doubt left that the child knows just what they stand for. It knows, I am I.
Some psychologists call attention to the fact that many children experience a feeling of something akin to terror when they first reach this sense of I, or individuality. Some writers have testified to having felt a strange sense of aloneness and detachment from all other things when this sense of individuality first burst upon them in early childhood. In some cases, the fuller dawn of self-consciousness is accompanied by a newly developed bashfulness, shyness, or that more or less morbid state known by the common name, self-conscious. With the faculty of introspection, there often comes the tendency to employ the same too freely, and thus to become morbid on the one hand, or else foolishly egotistical and vain on the other hand.
A writer well says of this particular state of newly awakened consciousness, "Although this feeling of separateness and apartness grows less acute as the man grows older, yet it is always present to a greater or less degree, until a still higher stage is reached, when it disappears. And this self-conscious stage is painful to many. Many find themselves entangled in a mass of mental states, which one thinks is himself, or inextricably bound up with himself. And the struggle between the awakening ego and its confining sheaths is very painful in some cases."
And this becomes more painful as the individual advances in self-consciousness and nears the end at which he is to find deliverance. Man eats of the tree of knowledge and begins to suffer, and is driven out of the Garden of Eden of the child consciousness in which the individual has lived like the birds, concerning not himself about the affairs of his higher nature. Man pays dearly for the gift of self-consciousness, yet it is worth it all, for finally he reaches heights of higher consciousness and is delivered from his burden.
With the dawning awareness of one's own mental states, one comes to the realization that other human beings possess similar states, and one begins to speculate and reason about the workings of these states in others. Then comes the desire to communicate one's ideas to the mind of others, and to appeal to his feelings or reason. All this promotes the development of intellect and logical thought, which is a marked characteristic of evolving human consciousness. Man begins to seek for an answer to the many whys which are presenting themselves to him, and he seeks to reason from the known to the unknown. He proceeds to invent appliances conducive to the accomplishment of things which lie desires. He harnesses his intellect to the chariot of his desires, and drives it along by command of will, the chariot driver.
Man indeed pays a price for this advanced consciousness. He pays a constantly increasing price as he advances into the new territory of conscious existence and experience. The more he knows, the more he desires, and the more he desires, the more does he suffer from the pain of not having. Capacity for pain is the price man pays for his advance in the scale, but he has a corresponding capacity for pleasure accompanying it. He has not only the pain of unsatisfied desires for possession of material things and physical wants, but also the pain arising from the lack of intelligent answers to the ever-increasing volume of problems presenting themselves for solution to his evolving intellect. And Lai also has pain of unsatisfied longings, disappointments, frustrated aims and ambitions, and all the rest of the list.
As man progresses, his wants multiply and his pain increases. New wants are but partly satisfied, and the unsatisfied remainder bring pain to him. Civilization becomes more and more complex, and new wants and lacks manifest themselves. Man attaches himself to things and creates for himself artificial wants which he must labor to meet. His intellect often fails to lead him upward, and too often merely enables him to invent new and subtle means and ways of gratifying his senses. Some men make a religion of the gratification of their sensuality and their appetites. Others become vain, conceited, and filled with an inflated sense of the importance of their personality. Others become morbidly introspective and spend their time analyzing and dissecting their moods, motives, and feelings. Others exhaust their capacity for pleasure and happiness by looking outside of themselves for happiness instead of within. These are the dark shadows cast by the bright light of human consciousness. However, the shadows always found as the opposite of all real evolutionary progress.
As man progresses in the scale of self-consciousness, however, he finds himself gradually detaching his sense of the self from its sheaths and working tools. He begins to realize that there is an I am within his being, to which all the feelings, the emotions, the desires, and even the thoughts and ideas are but incidents. In this high stage, he perceives himself to be an I am surrounded by his mental and emotional tools and belongings, a sun surrounded by its whirling worlds and activities. He realizes that the ego is not only superior to the body, but also to the mind and feelings, and he learns now only how to master and intelligently use his body, but also how to intelligently master and use his intellect and his emotions.
A well-known writer has said of man in this advanced stage, "If we are willing to believe in this mastery over the body, we must be prepared to believe in the mastery over our own inner thoughts and feelings. That a man should be prey to any thought that chances to take possession of his mind is commonly among us assumed as unavoidable. It may be a matter of regret that he should be kept awake all night from anxiety as to the issue of a lawsuit on the morrow, but that he should have the power of determining whether he should be kept awake or not seems an extravagant demand. The image of an impending calamity is no doubt odious, but its very odiousness, we say, makes it haunt the mind all the more pertinaciously, and it is useless to expel it."
Yet this is an absurd notion for man, the heir of all ages, hag-ridden by the flimsy creatures of his own brain. If a pebble in our boots torments us, we expel it. We take off the boot and shake it out. And once the matter is fairly understood, it is just as easy to expel an intruding and obnoxious thought from the mind. About this, there ought to be no mistake, no two opinions. The thing is obvious, clear, and unmistakable. It should be as easy to expel an obnoxious thought from the mind as it is to shake a stone out of your shoe. And till a man can do that, it is just nonsense to talk about his ascendancy over nature and all the rest of it. He is a mere slave and prey to the bat-winged phantoms that flit through the corridors of his own brain. Yet the weary and careworn faces that we meet by thousands, even among the affluent classes of civilization, testify only too clearly how seldom this mastery is obtained. How rare indeed to meet a true human. How common rather to discover a creature hounded on by tyrant thoughts or cares or desires, cowering, wincing under the lash, or perchance priding himself to run merrily in obedience to a driver that rattles the reins and persuades him that he is free. whom we cannot converse with in a careless tête-à-tête because that alien presence is always there on the watch.
Thank you, brilliant viewers, for your presence for today's episode of Between Master and Disciples. Join us again next Wednesday for part 2 of The Secret Doctrine of the Rosicrucians, the Three Higher Planes of Consciousness. Animal World, Our Co-Inhabitants is up next, after noteworthy news. Please stay tuned to Supreme Master Television. May your life shine with inner tranquility and compassion.
For more details, please visit www.suprememastertv.com/BMD.